Why do you think there's been this resurgence? What's behind it?
And this is one of those things I love, because everyone talks about, you know, old Paris. It's crusty, it's dusty, it's musty, you know, everything is new. But the things that are new are things that are American, you know, or like the coffee shop and... Enchanté.
Bonjour, this is Fabulously Delicious, the podcast that's all about delicious French food and the people that love it, cook it, produce it, talk, write and photograph it. Restaurants in France are an institution, you could say, and many treat them as such, becoming fans of, regulars at, and now, of course, in the day that we're living in now, Instagram uploading diners. There are actually many different types of restaurants in France, and I'm not talking types by cuisine, like Indian, Japanese, Italian, because of course there are those, but more so by category. I mean, Lyon has its bouchons, Brittany has its creperies, and in Paris in the late 1800s came along the bouillon. Today we are going to dine at, vicariously, of course, the bouillons that have reached a resurgence in the last 10 years in Paris with a Paris food fan. Our guest today loves the restaurant and cafe scene in Paris so much, she started a movement to save them. And even though our guest only has a part-time Parisian life, I'm sure we will learn a lot from her. Lisa Anselmo, thanks for joining me on Fabulously Delicious today.
It's so great to be here, Andrew. I'm looking forward to it.
Lisa, you're an author, speaker, coach, branding expert, the savior of the Paris cafe scene, lover of all things French food, but you have a secret that our listeners might not know, and I really want to explore this before we talk all things bouillons.
Oh, dear.
Do you know what your secret is? Yes.
I think you know more than I do.
You have a food passion, Lisa, that is not just about French food, but you're secretly a fan of the dark side, right? You love Italian food.
Of course I do. I'm Italian. I didn't have a choice. I was so worried where this was going.
Hilarious, as I like to say. So your parents, their parents were from Italy, is that right?
Right. All my grandparents came from Italy, like a lot of Italian Americans. And I was raised on Italian food. And in fact, I didn't even know that most Americans eat their salad before the meal, because we always had it after the meal. It's just what you do. It's sort of to sort of lighten, leggere, you know, to lighten the after the meal. And that's very Italian, very European. So I was raised on my mother was an amazing cook. And we ate all kinds of cuisine, but of course, Italian was like, you know, meat and potatoes to us.
So your mum's parents, they were from Abruzzo, and your dad's are from Sicily. What's the differences in food and cooking between those two areas?
Yeah, it's a big difference. So Abruzzo is...
Abruzzo. I love the way you say
Abruzzo,
that, by the way.
Abruzzo. It's an interesting region. The largest national park in Italy is there. And, you know, in 30 minutes, you could be either skiing in the mountains or lying on the beach. It's got a vast terrain. And it's actually well known for its cuisine, and a lot of Italian chefs study in Abruzzo because it's a lot of game, it's a lot of complex layered dishes that cook for long, long, long time. So in fact, the traditions are very similar to French cooking, to the cooking of Escoffier, actually. And in fact, my grandmother made her soup with a broth that she used a mirepoix, and that's very French, in fact. And I'm curious how that is that she had these techniques, and who did it first? Sicily, and I don't know a lot about Sicilian cooking, so I don't want to be wrong here, because I actually never ate Sicilian. I grew up eating Abruzzese food, but I'm going to guess, and based on what I see, and in general, the south of Italy is the cuisine that we know most, especially in America, because most of the immigrants came from Calabria, from Napoli, they came from Sicily, and the food tends to be lighter, quicker cooking, more garlic, you know, sautéed in oil, this kind of thing. And so it's a very different experience. Very, very different cuisine. And I wouldn't be, and the thing is, because it was independent city states for so long until the mid 1800s, every area has their own cuisine. I mean, if you're up in the north, it's going to be more like German food or Austrian food. You know, everything's a little different depending on the region. But I had those two regions to compare.
And have you been to both Abruzzo? I can't say this now. I'm going to get my I'm going to ruin Abruzzo. Have you been to Abruzzo and Sicily?
Okay, so I'm mortified to say I have never been to either of those places. I know.
Have you been to Italy?
Many times, but never to those regions. And there's a couple of reasons why. I actually was supposed to go in 2020, and those plans were foiled, like everybody's plans. I've never been to Sicily because I don't know the area, and it's not somewhere I want to go on my own. And it's very vast. And Abruzzo is the same. I have family there, and I need to do some research to find family. But it's somewhere I don't know, and I don't know anybody there. So I'm wandering around Italy by myself, you know. And so, unless I can find someone who wants to go, but I've been many, many times to Rome and Florence and Padova and Milan and, you know, various areas like that.
My parents, or my mother actually, she was half Italian. Her father was from northern Italy, up near Venice. My mother was also half Czechoslovak, what was then Czechoslovakia, so Czechoslovakian. She didn't get that Italian food tradition thing that so many people get and are so lucky to. So it sounds like your mum did, and that you got that growing up with fabulous Italian food. Is that right?
Absolutely. These recipes from our family are passed down from generation to generation. And my sister's she's a chef actually. So we carry on the tradition. Neither of us feel we can cook it as well as our mother did. And I'm sure our mother felt she didn't do as well as her mother did. But these recipes are in our family for, you know, hundreds of years.
Amazing. You grew up in New Jersey. Is there a large Italian community there?
Oh, big time. Absolutely. The whole tri-state area, as you can imagine, because the immigrants would come through Ellis Island and, you know, the famous Statue of Liberty. And my grandmother was actually processed through Ellis Island and then went on to Buffalo, where her husband-to-be was waiting for her. But there's a huge, 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 huge population, particularly there's certain counties in New Jersey, northeastern New Jersey, that have a lot of Italians, but really New Jersey's got a huge Italian population. Mostly they come from the south of Italy. And because of that, we have great pizzerias in New Jersey. Yes, of course, in New York and Brooklyn, but New Jersey has great pizzerias, and I was weaned on many, many good ones near me.
I don't know why I asked that question. I've just realized the Real Housewives in New Jersey, they're all Italian.
Hello. I think it's so funny that we're discussing the Real Housewives. I know. My mother would call them caffone.
Oh, what's that mean?
Gavone. Caffone means like, okay, every Italian hearing this is going to be mortified, but it's somebody who has no class, somebody who is, it's come to mean that. What it originally means, I have no idea. But of course, with the American term, American slang, it comes out as gavone. Ah, the gavone.
Actually, getting back to Italian food, what most do you love about Italian food?
Well, it's a question that's pretty packed because for me it's emotional, right? So, and actually I write about it in my book. I write about watching my grandmother make gnocchi, you know, with this machine-like precision of only years of practice can give, and us sitting around the table, you know, at Christmas Eve. And I have so many stories of that. It's the sitting at the table for hours, you know. We sit at the table Christmas at 2 p.m. and we don't get up till 2 a.m. You know, that's very normal. And so for me, it's an emotional hearkening back to familial life, to my childhood, and to the traditions that are the continuum in our lives. You know, even my sister and I, it's just she and I that are left. And you know, it's when we cook something of mom's and we talk about it on the phone and, you know, should we do this? Should we do no, ma not wouldn't have done it that way. You know, it's how connected it is to the our identity, my identity of who I am and who our family is. Cause every family has their own traditions and their own particular recipes.
How does that love of Italian food, that love of home compare to your love of French food?
Well, I think what I love about French food is how much it's similar, the eating of it and the family quality, familial and the social quality around it, how similar that is to Italian food. I mean, it's Europe, right? So for me, and because of the food from my heritage, Abruzzo, is so similar in terms of its richness. You know, our spaghetti sauce takes all day to cook. You know, you start with a big quantity, and by the time it's done, it's half of that, and it's black. Like, my grandmother's sauce was black. And so it's got the same, it's amazing. It's so rich in flavors and so many meats, and it's long. It's a long cooking process. So that's kind of similar to some traditional, a lot of traditional French cooking. And I just, it's familiar, and I think that that's part of what I love about it. And just being in Europe obviously makes me feel close to my roots. So there's that. And it's just, you know, it's the love of food. It's how the French plan their day around eating.
So in 2006, you wrote a book, Part-Time Paris Life. It's a memoir of sorts. It's written after your mum passed, unfortunately, from breast cancer. My dad passed 3 months before moving to France, and then my mum the year after moving here. So I know the loss of your parents and what being in Paris at that time is like. You probably talk about this in your book, but how did life in Paris help or hinder your grief process after your mum passed away?
Such a good question. And I didn't know we had that in common. You know, my mother's death was a huge catalyst for me. So I had put her in the center of my universe. And, I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. So she was sort of everything to me. And when she died, I realized that I didn't know who I was on my own terms. And I became very, very depressed. And I got the idea in my head of getting a pied-à-terre in Paris. I inherited some money. It's a tiny place. Didn't cost a lot. But it became this toehold, literally a pied-à-terre, became a toehold into Paris, which I had been coming for many years and had many friends. And so it was my happy place. And I had it in my head that I needed this apartment. But it was a very, very brave thing for me to do. I would never have done that normally. And when I did it, and I literally flew out for a weekend, picked a place, and flew back. It's the crazy stuff I would have never done. And the boldness of that changed me. And so when the opportunity to take a package at work, I used to work at People Magazine. I took it, but with trepidations, even though I had huge projects in Paris that were getting tons of press, the whole world was saying, go to Paris, go to Paris. Like, the universe was pushing me. In fact, I got the book deal the day I decided to take a package. So the universe was like, we're going to reward you for being brave. So I came to Paris. It was really just to be happy. You know, in my mind, it was a place to be happy. So I told this whole story just to explain, answer your question. I came here thinking I was going to be in this amazing Zen place. I was going to write my book. It was all going to be shiny pennies all day. And instead, I arrived to a leak. The apartment would become completely destroyed by it because the neighbor would refuse to repair it until I got a lawyer. And so I had to move out of my apartment because I'm allergic to mold. So here I come to live this dream, and I end up getting scrambling to try and find a rental. And the trip wasn't anything that I planned, and I had put all these expectations on it. So I was actually miserable for the first 2 months until I realized, like, oh, you know what? This is your book. Like, this thing you're going through is your book. It could be very good and very funny. And then I also had a lot of time to myself, which was hell, because I had this busy, busy job, and suddenly it was all unplugged, and now I had only me and my grief. And so it forced me to face my life, my choices, and deal with my grief, because I was by myself in a strange city that I thought I knew, but when living here is not vacationing here and in Paris. I say here because I'm in Paris. And so I was courageous enough to make that move, and then it made me really tap into that courage. And I'm not the same person I was when I started that journey, that I began to do bolder and bolder things. I know I finished the book. I started the series. That's the same name, My Part-Time Paris Life. We shot it in 2015. And that's, again, all bold, bold, big, big stuff that I would have never done. And that's what I think Paris itself, the strokes and slaps of expat life, you sink or swim. But you learn and you grow so much if you're willing to stick it out and you're willing to take those slaps and turn them into lessons, life lessons. And so it shaped me for the next 30 years of my life.
Before we get into all things bouillon, I wanted to ask you about an obsession that I've realized you have. We also have it in common. But what is it about French butter that you love so much?
Oh, man. You know the original tagline of my blog used to be, I bought an apartment in Paris so I could take home the butter. It tastes more of milk fat than of grease. And the butter in the U.S. just tastes greasy. I don't understand what they're doing wrong. And it's the creaminess. It's the sweetness. I remember the first time I was 16, I came to Paris for the first time and had the butter with the orange marmalade on a baguette and thought, oh, I've died and gone to heaven. You know, it's just, I will always have like 4 bars of butter in my freezer at any given time because you can never run out. That's the worst. It's the creaminess and the sweetness that is like nothing else. And I'm sure maybe the butter in Italy and Ireland, I hear that's great too. But I'm here. So it's just amazing. And the way it cooks, you know, it doesn't burn right away. I don't know what it is. It's magical.
You mentioned butter from Ireland. I'm wanting to go and taste that now because, yes, I think you might be right. The cows would be eating all those 4-leaf clovers.
I don't know. Very lucky butter.
Exactly.
I hear. The legend is that it's very good.
You're listening to Fabulously Delicious, the podcast that's all about French food and the wonderful and fabulous people that make it. If you'd like to support the making of Fabulously Delicious, then there are many ways you can do this. The first, and by far most possibly the most important, is to follow wherever you listen to podcasts. That's Apple, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. Also, leave a review and a rating. A 5-star rating would be fabulous. Merci beaucoup. Financially, you can support Fabulously Delicious by becoming a Patreon member for as little as the price of a copy. Let's start that again, shall we? For as little as the price of a cup of coffee a month, you can become a Patreon member and receive, obviously I'm having a problem talking to you today, and receive exclusive content just for you. I'm currently rejuvenating all the options on Patreon, so stay tuned for more information on that. But not everybody can support monthly, so if you'd like to, you can just do a one-off payment via the Buy Me a Coffee website, where you can buy me a croissant. Both the Patreon and the Buy Me a Coffee croissant links are on the show notes for this episode. Thanks for all your support and the fabulous Patreon members that are already there. Thanks also for listening to Fabulously Delicious. And now let's get back to our chat with Lisa Ansimo and all things bouillon, the restaurant, not the stock cubes. Although stock cubes do get a mention. On to our topic today, the bouillon. Can you explain what is a bouillon?
So a bouillon, it actually refers to a type of dish. And it's a dish of broth and meat. And it was actually invented by a butcher, Pierre-Louis Duval, in the mid-1800s. He was in Layal, and he was sick of wasting the parts of the meat that the bourgeoisie didn't want to buy. So he created this idea of this broth, and it was for the workers at Layal, so they could eat something cheap and quick and good and hearty. And that began, and they became very popular. There were more stalls than actual restaurants, you know, in the 1800s. And they were cheap and, you know, these little places. And there were, by 1900, there were 250 bouillon in Paris.
If you're going through a Paris supermarket or if you're, French supermarket, or if you're, say, looking into a cookbook, you'll often get a bouillon, they'll mention a bouillon. So that's a stock cube is what I would know it as in Australia.
Right, a bouillon cube. Mm-hmm.
Is that where it comes from?
I'm going to guess that's where it comes from, because it really does come from the verb bouillir. And I wouldn't be surprised, because what is it? It's a meat stock, right? It's some kind of meat stock. So I wouldn't be surprised, yeah, if it came from the actual de bouillon.
And you mentioned that it was close to Layal. And so just to let our listeners know that they might not know, because many people would go to Paris and see Layal as a great big shopping center, but it was actually a food market.
Right, the belly of Paris, right, Emile Zola. Yes, it was a giant, I think there were 6 giant, six buildings, glass buildings, like six covered markets, I feel like I want to say. And it was where all the food, the main food market of the city, which is now outside the city in the suburbs. And it wasn't just for, you know, the regular folk, it was for the industry as well. And then, of course, it was demolished in the 70s, and then they realized that this was historic and they shouldn't have done so. The problem with it being in the center of the city, obviously, is food waste and the rats and all these problems it was creating. But then they demolished the buildings, which were beautiful. And so that's why they, when they redemolished what Leal had become and they built the new one, they wanted to bring back the idea of this glass canopy, the roof. But yeah, now it's just like a shopping mall, and it's yeah, it's not what it was.
Two things that I love about Paris now, actually, is one, since going back after confinements, is that the last remaining hall has been turned into the Pinault private collection. So they didn't knock down all six. They kept one, and that one was the Bourse de Commerce. And now it's been completely renovated and was bought by Pinault, French billionaire, and he houses his private collection in there. And it's just the most amazing exhibition. It's literally, I think, just opened in the last 3 or 4 months. But, of course, the other thing that the demolishing of Leal gave us was the promenade. Well, it's no longer the promenade de Plantin, but the Viaduct des Arts and the what I know as the Promenade de Plantin in the Bastille, because that train line closed. Once Leal in the 70s, 80s, that train line closed and they made that park on top, like the New York High Line.
Right, and it came before the High Line, and that's nearby where I live. So,
The bouillon was, you mentioned, getting back to it, was invented by Pierre-Louis Duval. His restaurants or stores ended up being like the first chain stores, right? There was like lots of them.
This was the first fast food, essentially. There were, like I said, there were 250 around 1900, but they were all differently owned, right? Because it came the trend. So the Chartier brothers, they opened up the first one that is the most well-known because it was the one that survived the longest, the one on Faubourg Montmartre near Grand Boulevard in the center of the city. They opened that in 1896. But that was a very radical departure from what the Bouillon had been. The Bouillon had been, like I say, these little holes in the wall, you know, like a little fast, right? It's like a little, they created this huge space. I mean, Chartier, I don't know if anyone's ever been in it, but it is as tall as it is wide. It's this massive, massive ceiling, and it's bright, and it's very, you know, it feels, you know, for the day, it was very elegant. So imagine you're a worker, and you're going to have your quick meal, and you're suddenly transported into this beautiful, bright space. And that, so in that way, it's very revolutionary because, you know, it's not an expensive meal, you're not wealthy, but you are in a space worthy of, you know, a king. And that must have been so transportative for anyone who went in there, even for the 20 minutes or the 30 minutes they're there. And that's what I think, you know, Frédéric and Camille, I think that's Chartier. I think that's what they brought to this fast food experience was, why shouldn't it be a nice space too? And that began what we know as the Bouillon in these luxurious looking Art Nouveau spaces. So Art Nouveau was de rigueur at the time. It was the tendance. It was the trendy style. And so there was the Bouillon. It was Bouillon Gandal Duval or Gandal Fournier that opened up in 1903, and that was Edouard Fournier. So they were like now suddenly the Chartier brothers had competition, and Fournier was it, and they were egging each other on. And that actually is what's Julien now. So that was in Rue du Faubourg. I guess you have to be on a street called Rue du Faubourg or something. Rue du Faubourg Saint-Denis. And that was in this beautiful, opulent Art Nouveau style. So again, imagine you're going to have like a 2 cents bowl of soup and you're in this beautiful space. So that in itself was really revolutionary. And, you know, you're giving this, the middle class and the working class a boost up in a way, culturally and psychologically. And so that actually then became Julien. But then another one opened up, somebody else, in what is now Vagenonde. So in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, And that's something I wanted to talk about. Anyway, so the Charte, but it's not to be outdone, opened two more, Bouillon, one on Boulevard Montparnasse and one on Rue Racine in the Fifth, which are both still there. So Rue Racine, that location is a historic landmark now, and it still says Bouillon Camille Chartier, even though it's not called that anymore. So that's sort of like, that was the beginning of this luxurious looking Bouillon. And I'll tell you, there are many brasseries that actually were Bouillon before, like Vagenonde. And Julien was a brasserie for years and years and years, if you remember. And then it became again, and we'll talk about this, it became again a Bouillon.
The first Bouillon started, so to speak, with what we talked about, a beef soup. And then how did this emergence of the Art Nouveau and how did the numerous new venues and the Art Nouveau venues of the Bouillon change the Bouillon's menu?
Well, I don't have any evidence of the original Chartier menu, although the one that they have now has been the one they've been using since the 30s. But Fournier, he had a philosophy, and it was, here everything is beautiful, delicious, and of great value. So the menu was fairly expansive and, of course, very affordable. So it had a lot of the dishes of the day, like, you know, tête de veau and, you know, choucroute alsacienne and all these things that we've come to know as brasserie food, right? Because it's essentially the same, right? I mean, the Bouillon is actually the first brasserie in many ways, the first one that Duval created. But it was so not to deprive or not to. Again, it's what I was saying, revolutionary in its way because A, it was the first fast food. B, it was inexpensive. C, in an incredible, beautiful space. And then the food also had a sense of value, right? Like, you deserve this nice meal in this nice space, and we're not going to gouge you for it. I mean, just think about how, that's very revolutionary at a time, you know, during the Belle Époque. You know, I mean, the city's always had struggles between rich and poor, and this was sort of a hugely egalitarian move.
Today, there's been a resurgence of the Bouillon. Before we talk about specific places, I wanted to ask you, why do you think there's been this resurgence? What's behind it?
You know, this is one of those things I love, because everyone talks about, you know, old Paris, it's crusty, it's dusty, it's musty, you know, everything is new. But the things that are new are things that are American, you know, or like the coffee shop and the burgers, right? But that they're saying young people don't want all this kind of heavy food. They don't like it anymore. And you know what? It's not true. It's just that it was tucked away inside of expensive brasseries. And I've been faulted for being too nostalgic and being too stuck in the past. But the thing is, a good idea is a good idea is a good idea. And we need this now more than ever. Paris is so expensive. And there's a lot of young people that are struggling to be here. And the idea of a bouillon where you can have good, hearty food for cheap, of course it's a great idea. It was a great idea then. It's a great idea now. And it's why suddenly there's a resurgence. And if you see the lines outside waiting to get in, because there's always a line, it's young people. Right. And for me, this is what the resurgence of the Bouillon, why it makes me a little too smugly glee. Because you know, like I told you so, it's to see these foods, these traditional French foods, finding their way into the bellies of a new generation, being loved and eaten and embraced. I mean, tête de veau, I mean, who would ever think? Right? The younger generation is embracing it wholeheartedly. So it's nothing to do with changing taste. It had everything to do with changing price. And this is, to me, the brilliance of the Bouillon is that now a whole new generation of young Parisians are discovering and enjoying this food again. And it's uniquely French. It's uniquely Parisian. Right? And that's what makes me so excited about this idea and so happy about it, is that it's a good idea. Bring it back. Why wouldn't you?
So now, in this time of resurgence, where can we go for a really traditional bouillon experience in Paris?
They're all traditional. Here's the beauty. here's the beauty. I gotta do my due diligence. So look, Chartier reopened. It was called Montparnasse 1900 on Boulevard Montparnasse. It was a brasserie for years. It's again a Chartier, Bouillon Chartier. Julien reclaimed its original vocation, was a brasserie for years, and is now again a Bouillon, and that's on Rue du Faubourg Saint-Denis. That's a little more of the pricier one. All the menus are really, really traditional. Chartier, of course, is number one. But there's the newer ones that would be interesting to check out, and that's by the Moissier brothers. And they're two like Bobo hipster dudes, right? And they have Chartier, they have Bouillon Pigalle on Avenue de Clichy. And that they built from the ground up. That's not an old anything. That is a brand new two-story Bouillon. And I'm telling you, the menus, I'll give you an example. And they just opened a new one called Bouillon République. And that's where the old Chez Jenny used to be. And that was an old brasserie that I used to go to all the time. I miss it. But I'll give you an example of the menus. And like where can you get an entree, an appetizer for a euro 90, right? That's and it's oeuf de mayonnaise. I mean, this is the stuff that your grandmother ate, right? Or like, you know, the you can get a confit de canard for 11 euros or a cuisse de poulet for 9 euros. This is the kind of food that's there, and it's to all traditional. Like, and this is from the new Bouillon Pigalle. They dug it right up in the past and are reserving it for cheap.
But how, okay, I don't want to be a cynic here, but how do they make money? Because, you know, you talk to a restaurateur or a chef, part of the reason why Paris is so expensive is because, you know, you have really high rents. You know, the cost of good ingredients, quality ingredients, is really expensive now. You know, the wages, how electricity, don't get me started on electricity. How do they make money with having such a cheap thing? So is it back to the old days? Is it food for the masses? Are you supposed to, like, is it a place that you can go to with your laptop and sit inside a bouillon and on a meal and work for 3 hours? Or are they going to kick you out after?
Yeah, they make money on covers and turnover. That's how they make their money. So, like, if you wait online at any of these places, if you wait more than 20 minutes, it's a lot. You're in and you're out. And that's why it's the fast food. It was the original fast food. It's, you know, if you're there an hour, that's a lot, you know, but it's still a wonderful experience. And, you know, look, the food isn't brilliant. It's respectable. You know, I had a printer that used to have a sign up on the wall, good, fast, cheap, pick any two, you know, but it's good. I mean, I've never had a bad meal. It's not, you know, I wouldn't write home about it, but they make their money in quantity, turnover and number of tables, number of seats, covers, they call it in the business. And obviously because of that, they can buy large quantities of food, they get a discount. You know, I'm not a restaurateur, but I'm assuming it really has to do with having a fixed menu, cooking it in bulk, and churning it out in rapid succession.
And getting back to your Italian roots, is there an Italian equivalent to the bouillon?
Oh, totally. And they have it in Paris too, in France too. You know, the truck stop, right? The roadside stand, the roadside restaurant. They call them here routier, which is another trend coming back. There's all these routier-themed restaurants. And again, they're serving traditional food for not so much, not as cheap as a bouillon. But so we have a running joke, my Italian friends and I, that we'll have some pasta in New York and they'll say, you know, it's good. It's like, you know, train station food in Italy. You know, it's of the quality of a train station because you can get decent food at the side of a road. You know, they have these little roadside. In the U.S., we have McDonald's at these rest stops. Right. But in Italy, they have these wonderful little restaurants and the food's great and it's cheap. And it's, again, it's meant to be something you pass through, you fill your belly and you move on.
Finally, a question I ask everyone. What is the most fabulous thing about France to you?
I think it's, well, I'd have to say the cafes, the cafe culture and the food culture that goes with that. It's this idea of conviviality around food. That the focus on food is the center of the social gathering. That is something that's very unique. It's Italian too, and I talked about this earlier, but for me, I would have to say my life in Paris, the cafes are the thing, and that's why I have Save the Paris Cafe, because we've lost 500 cafes since 2014, and we just spent 8 months without cafes when we had lockdown. And we know what Paris is like without a cafe. It's not livable. It's the ability to sit at a terrace and have a glass of wine or a cafe, a coffee, and watch the world go by is something that is like nowhere else. You certainly can't do it in New York. And I think I can boil it down to that just because having not had it, I know how important it is to quality of life here.
Lisa, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for telling us all about the bouillon and also about your secret obsessions, Italian food and French butter. Oh, what could be better? Thank you for joining us on Fabulously Delicious today.
Thank you for having me. This was so much fun.